Well, that should be a good test to see
if you talk like that.
So I think maybe, you know, you just, when you lose your hearing, you just can't, well, it's just nothing that takes the place of it, you know, except that a hearing aid does help. But then you just live accordingly.
Yes. However, you do manage pretty well.
Oh, I do. I don't get everything. It doesn't worry me if I don't get every word.
Well, I think testing-wise, it looks like it's working. And I'm Neville Jacobs, and this is Dr. Lydia Von Hansen. On what, the 23rd of June, are we?
This is the 24th, I believe.
Is it really? And Dr. Von Hansen, where did you come from originally?
I was born in Iowa and lived there most of my life before I came to Alaska. I was graduated from Iowa State with a bachelor's degree in 1919, and I taught in Iowa, and went back for my master's in 22. Then I taught at Ames for 3 years, and that was when Dr. Bunnell wrote to the Dean of Home Economics at Iowa State and asked if she had two home economics teachers that she could...
Wait a minute.
I have a tax.
You get coughing attacks too. Well, anyway, so Dr. Bunnell wrote to the University of Iowa?
Dean of Home Economics Department at Iowa, at Ames, and asked for two home economics teachers, asked her to recommend someone. So I had a friend teaching in the same department that I was in, and she wanted to come to Alaska very badly, and so she talked me into it.
Oh!
So Dr. Bunnell came to Iowa State, and on a very hot summer day, and
I think you're too close to the mic. I don't know. It's never squawked like that.
Mic too.
I don't know what the problem is there. No. It may have been that it was just turned up too high. Okay. So let's go on. It was squeaking there for some reason. I've never gotten a feedback from it like that. So the two of you came.
Yes. We, he said he had, see, the University of Alaska was known as the Agricultural College and School of Mines, and it was the last land-grant college to be organized, and it opened in 22. And so this was the third year at the university. There had been two home economics teachers before me, but they married and so were lost to the department. Mm-hmm. And so Dr. Bunnell thought if he had two teachers, at least one of them would stay for a while. So I was appointed head of the department because I had a master's degree, and Martha Park was my assistant. So we came to the university with misgivings, of course, to stay a year. But we stayed 4 years.
You did?
Yes.
I'm going to set the machine further away from the mic. In fact, why don't we shift over here to get the mic away from the machine? I think it's picking up. Sometimes that's a problem.
It's maybe my hearing aid.
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. No, I think it was the sound of the machine, a machine next to the microphone like that sometimes get feedback. Mm-hmm. But that's fine.
So many magazines these days.
I have stacks of them, and I don't know what to do with them either. But anyway, now, well, this is most interesting. So you in 22 then you came, 1922?
No, came in 25.
25. And you stayed 4 years at that time.
Yes. I had married in 1927. And my husband was a prospector and miner, and so in 1929 we decided to take a trip back to the States to meet my people, and I wasn't going to teach anymore. And so when we came back in 1930, they had arranged to start the extension service at the university, and Dr. Monell needed someone to take over the work with women and the 4-H club work and so on. So extension work was started in July in 1930, and I was to be in charge of the programs for women and 4-H club work. And Professor Gasser was in charge of the agriculture and gardening and so on. So so I continued then in that position, and it was pioneering, getting into communities, trying to explain what extension service was all about, and trying to get people involved in programs that would make for a better living in Alaska. And so it was exciting work, and I enjoyed every bit of it. But in 1935, my husband had gone into partnership to open a mine on Deadwood Creek in the Circle area. So I resigned and thought I wouldn't be teaching anymore. So I went. So we spent 2 summers at Deadwood when my husband became quite ill with silicosis and tuberculosis. So that was when we went to Arizona. And he died in 1938. So I stayed in the States a year or two, and in the meantime they had appointed other people. Miss McDonald was in charge of the extension work for women. But when I came back to Alaska in 1940, she was very anxious to leave. She had had a better job, or one that she thought she would like better, and couldn't see much future in the work here in Alaska, trying to reach so many different communities and not being able to spend much time in any one community. So Dr. Bunnell asked me to take the position again. And so from 1940 till the time I retired in 59, I was doing extension work.
I had some questions way back there. What was I going to ask you? Oh, for one thing, what was the foundation, the background for extension work elsewhere before it came here?
Well, it was it was based on the Morrill Act of 62, when money was made available to the states to work in practical subjects and work directly with farm people, but it wasn't until somewhat later before the states began adopting taking advantage of this money that was available to the states. But the First World War, of course, made it very important to increase production, and that was when extension service really caught on in the states, and that was when the leaders in extension work emphasized the help that they could give to farmers to improve their yields and to farm women to improve their skills in gardening and sewing and all the practical crafts and arts, and especially to increase their management and make farm life more attractive to the women as well as to the farmer. And so, but it wasn't until 1930 that funds became available to Alaska, because Alaska had a very small or limited farm population, for one thing, and in fact a very small population for the size of the state, and in the states where some of the cities were much larger than the total population of Alaska. And so I think that was one reason that they had not been able to get funds for extension work. But you see, the Land Grant College really has 3 divisions. There's the campus part of it, the building and the campus and the faculty. Then there's the research department, where they spend a certain amount of money in researching all the problems, practical problems of production and marketing, and some is pure science, some is applied science, you see. And then they felt that they must have people who can take the results of extension work, I mean of research work, out to the people who are really practicing it and who need it. So it took some time before it could be brought to Alaska. But by the time extension work started in Alaska, we had a lot of help from the state extension, the other state extension offices. They had gone through all of this pioneering work.
Out of Juneau, in a sense.
No, out of the states, you see.
The other states, of course. I see, it wasn't a separate
We were a territory at that
time.
Yes,
that's right, of course.
But a lot of research had been done in farming and in horticulture and dairying and forage crops and nutrition of animals. And by 1930 was when people began to be very concerned about vitamins and minerals and good nutrition and health problems and management problems, and so we could profit by much of the work that had been done in the States in organizing it and in methods of presenting it. And so we did go out to conferences and conventions and get as much information as we could from other areas.
Well, when you came here in 25 originally,
yes.
Now, the university itself was 3 or 4 years old then.
It was 3 years. Miss Kirkpatrick was the first head of the home economics department. She stayed 2 years. And then Miss Trail took her place and stayed only 1 year.
How many students were in the department?
I haven't looked it up recently. I know there weren't very many. There weren't very many people taking home economics. We almost always had one graduate in home economics, and but much of our work was with short courses and getting the women of the town interested in the university and giving demonstrations and short course work that would appeal to women living in town or to other students and those enrolled in home economics at the university. And I know when I came to the university, Miss Trail had ordered a loom and lots of yarn and felt that the women of Fairbanks would enjoy doing some weaving and learning weaving. And she also had materials for many other crafts. And so when we offered short courses, why people could come out and use the loom, and we tried to develop interest in child care and in old furnishings, home furnishings, and all the subjects that are included in a home economics department. So the university grew very slowly, very gradually, and for the 4 years that we were that Martha and I were there,
were the women in town interested?
What subjects?
No. To what extent were they interested in the?
Well, I was looking at one of the old collegiums, and we had totaled up 1 year over 100 women attending different, not all at the same time, but different courses, and then we offered a variety of subjects, you know.
Fairbanks. We tend to think of Fairbanks as a frontier mining town, and life in a frontier mining town is thought of as rough. But actually, Fairbanks had a wide assortment of people. It was, of course, in the mid-20s, it was it wasn't 1900, it was past the boom days.
Yes.
It had settled into a fairly stable, small town.
Well, yes, Fairbanks had many ways of creating interest in plays and concerts, and it was all their activities were pretty much home directed. We didn't have many people coming from the States to give special courses or to stimulate interest in this or that or the other thing. It was pretty much homemade, but there were many professional people in Fairbanks. They had fine musicians, they had some good some artists, of course, and and many speakers, many, and of course the political life was quite interesting. Everybody was interested in who was going to be the next delegate to Congress, and who was going down to Juneau, and so. But of course, Fairbanks had, in the 20s, in the early 20s, Fairbanks was almost a dead town. But always something, when Fairbanks almost became a ghost town, then something would happen that would stimulate interest in coming to Alaska. So in the 20s, of course, it was the big FE company, the Fairbanks Exploration Company, was opening up in the area for dredging. The cream of the crop had been skimmed off by the placer miners, and now they were ready to open up dredges, and that brought a lot of people to Fairbanks. Of course, in early in the 20s, it was the railroad that brought people. They completed the railroad to Seward, and so I think when I came in 25, it was maybe a town close to 3,000 and was growing.
There was a change then taking place right at that period, in a way.
Yes.
The character of the town was beginning to change. A certain more stable population, in a sense, was coming in.
There were, I think any frontier place, you know, when after families arrive and schools have to be built and churches and so on, well, then the town begins to be stable.
Yes,
and,
yes, of course.
And people begin to realize that it is going to stay. That,
yes.
That we could feel the change from the first years. Everybody was trying to make money to go back to the States and spend it in the States, you know, so people never planned on staying here. However, it was surprising to me when I came to find that many of the people in Fairbanks had never even seen the United States. They had come from Europe, but they came to around the or through the canal and up to Seattle, you see, and had not lived in the States. There were many German, many Irish, many Italians. They were brought in to work on the railroad, and so Fairbanks, right from the start, had a very cosmopolitan population.
Well, that's an interesting point. I had never thought of that. And of course, there are a lot of people here from the Slavic regions.
Oh yes, yes, and and those people were not going anyplace. They were going to stay here, and I think they helped to stabilize the town, because they had no place in the States to go.
That and they were concerned with education, apparently.
Yes, and with making it a permanent place, you know, building permanent homes and, and building up the economy of the territory.
Now, when you came up, how did you come?
Well, I came from Iowa to Seattle, but I drove across country, and then I came.
That was quite a trip in 1925.
Yeah, it was. And then from Seattle by boat, I think we came up on the old, what was it? I've forgotten right now. But we came to Seward, and that took about 5 days. And then from Seward, it took 1 day to get to Curry, and then you stayed overnight at Curry, and then you came to Fairbanks the next day. However, we didn't do that, and we felt terribly cheated, because there was a washout on the railroad, and we had to stay in Anchorage.
Oh.
And so we had to stay overnight in Anchorage for, I think, 3 days. And then we came on and didn't get to stay overnight at Curry. We got in Fairbanks about 3 o'clock in the morning, I think, 4 o'clock.
When I came up from Anchorage to Fairbanks, the first time was 53 I came up. And they had just changed that you didn't have to stop at Curry anymore. But we stopped there for lunch. And the men on the train were telling us, now I wasn't a real newcomer then, but it was my first train trip. And I'd been in Alaska 4 or 5 years at that time, but they were telling us how this used to be the overnight stop, and now with these really wonderful fast trains, how we can zoop up to Fairbanks in one day. And I think it was a 12-hour run then.
Mrs. Bunnell and Jean happened to be on the boat when Martha and I came to Alaska, and so it was really nice to get acquainted with her, and they took such a special interest in the new teachers. It was the teacher boat. That is, it was a boat that came in just before school started, so there were many teachers coming to Alaska to teach, not all of them coming to the university, but they spread out from here to many other schools. And so it was an interesting trip, and very interesting to someone who had grown up in the Middle West and never been on a boat before.
Yes, that trip is a thrill. That was a sad loss for Alaska.
Yes.
When those old boats went out.
Yes.
I came up on the Aleutian, and I know that the mountains got taller and taller, mm-hmm. and everybody was talking about how you had to lean back a little further and a little further as you went north. But we came up in June. There were many geologists and engineers coming up at that time.
Yes, that's the research crews coming in.
Yes, that's when the research people come for the summer. Now, you came then in the fall, in September, when the teachers came.
I remember in Seward, we had to stay, I think we stayed overnight in Seward to catch the train the next morning. I know we were walking all around town to see what we could see, and some man was out in his garden picking strawberries, and he says, "Just come in, help yourself." So so we went in and ate all the strawberries we wanted. We thought, there were many beautiful gardens and lots of things like that surprised us.
Well, in 1949, in June, it was 49 when I arrived, on board the ship was a man who had lived, a petroleum engineer, who had been at Point Barrow off and on through the years in various parts of Alaska. So when we got into Seward, we went into a grocery, we went shopping, he went browsing through town with my mother and myself and some others. And in a grocery store, he just picked up a sack and sacked up some cherries. And I looked at the price on them, and I can remember, I think they were 69, they might have been 79 cents a pound, something like that, but, for red cherries. And all I could do was just stare at the price. "Oh, well," he said, "you'll get used to that," because I think at that time they were 20-something a pound, maybe, or 10 cents a pound in California, where I come from. And he said, "You'll get used to this." He says, "After a while, you'll just go buy what you need, and you won't even think about what the price says, because anywhere you go, the prices are just so high."
They used to say that eating and cooking were the chief sports in Alaska, and I believe that food became very important to people. When it was expensive, of course.
Well, that's right. Food is important to us up here.
But most of the women in Alaska were very good cooks and had learned to to make good meals with what they had and use the local berries, local meats and fish.
Well, this was something when I first came up that I noticed how concerned people were in using the local foods, which are fairly limited, actually. There's certain limited numbers of kinds of game you have,
yes,
and how to make them palatable.
That was one of our big problems in early extension work, was to get recipes for the use of berries and foods that they could obtain locally, the greens and the plant and the mushrooms and things like that. So, and then of course to get the nutritive value of Alaska foods. I know there was some fly-by-night reporter who got articles printed in the papers in the States saying that the vegetables grew so fast in Alaska that they had no nutritive value.
You know, I remember hearing that.
Mr. Brown, what was his name? Brown, anyway. And there was no topsoil, and that people were starving, and that, it was a ridiculous article. And we had to try to refute some of those statements. And then they, and then to make attractive or livable furniture and furnishings out of what was available was something that women were always interested in. And remodeling and fixing what they had. So so there were many problems. There are many problems living in Alaska, you know. And
well, when you started in the 30s, and by taking the program to the outlying, to the rural areas, where did you go?
Well, we had a very limited budget, and we couldn't waste it on getting out too far where there was where there were very few people. So the supervisor in Washington, D.C. said that anything, any place with a population of less than 2,500 or up to 2,500, it was considered a rural area. You see, this program was started mainly for farms and rural people. But he said all the places in Alaska
would qualify.
Would qualify, and not to make too much distinction between what was rural and what was city, because we had so few cities. So, so he went with us on the first extension trip, and we just went down the railroad and stopped at Palmer. Of course, it wasn't Palmer in those days; it was Matanuska, where the experiment station is, and. Then we went on to Anchorage, of course, and had some meetings there, and to Seward, and had some meetings there, and then we went on down to Juneau, and Petersburg, and Sitka, and Ketchikan, I think, were the, and Wrangell. I think those were the places we visited first, and then, of course, I tried to make the trip at least once a year to southeast Alaska, and then a more intensive program in Fairbanks, and there was a little town out of Chattanooga, and down to Nenana, many beautiful gardens in Nenana, and quite a few families there. So we had a fairly good program going in those places. Then of course, the last year I was with extension work before we went mining was in 35, when the colonists arrived in Palmer, and so they asked me to go down and work with the colonists for the summer. And so that year I didn't get to some of the other places. We had visited quite a few of the villages, although it was by 34, 35, there were planes going out to Nome and to some of the villages, Fort Yukon and so on, so that we could get to those places. And but when you can visit a place only once a year or twice a year, it's very hard to keep an organized club going, like 4-H club work. You know, you'd get a group and a leader, and you'd get them all lined up on a project. Then maybe the leader would move away, or something would happen, and you couldn't get back there to give them much help. So it was hard to keep organized work going. So we emphasized more the interest groups. Go to a town, get a group of women interested in learning something about sewing and clothing, and then work with that group. Or interested in nutrition, well, work with that group, and so on. But I did spend the summer with the colonists in Palmer, and there were the 10 camps, you know, with the different groups in each camp, and we did do a lot of canning demonstrations. My office was a tent in Palmer, and as the houses were completed, where the people moved out of their tents in Palmer. Well, they did place tents in the areas where their farms were, you know. So so after they drew lots for their farms, well, then they gradually were moved out to these places. So I had about 10 camps that I used to visit quite regularly.
Where were these camps?
Oh, they're scattered all over the valley, because they couldn't get land so that the farms all were in one spot, you see. They had to take the land where they could get deed to it, where they could could really...
It was all open federal land, wasn't
no,
it?
No, no. You see, there were a lot of settlers who had taken homesteads.
Oh, prior to their
yes.
the arrival
oh,
of the
yes.
homestead groups?
Yes.
The settlement groups.
So the new settlers had to be scattered all over the valley. And that changed the idea in Washington, D.C. They thought that they would have a little tight colony, you know, all, I think they drew 80 acres. They didn't get a whole homestead, you see. They got 80 acres. And if they had been all together in one area, they could have had canning factories and things of that kind. But they were so scattered around that they just had to fit
oh,
into the community.
Oh, this is something I didn't know, and I really have never... I guess there is a book out on them.
Oh, yes, I am. I'd be glad to. You can borrow the
oh,
one I have if you want to.
Oh, I'd like to read it.
Right.
I've never read that. And so I really don't know some of the finer details. But what happened in Washington that they didn't know? That it, I wonder. Do you have any idea?
Well, you can't... well, it's absentee planning. The people in Washington sitting at a desk had very little idea of what Alaska was like or what any area was like. And so while an Alaskan went there to advise them, they didn't pay much attention to him. I think Don Irwin was sent to Washington, D.C. to advise them. And he was in charge of the experimental farm at Palmer. The Matanuska farm, but I don't think he that they listened to him very much because the machinery was sent up, machinery that they wouldn't need till the next year was sent up in the first load, and the things they needed most didn't come till later. It was a very hectic time for the people, and uprooted from their own states. You know, there was a group from Michigan and a group from Minnesota, and a group from Wisconsin. And of course, when they drew lots, these people were scattered all over the valley. But it was interesting, and I found many of them very very fine people and very anxious to fit in, to learn all they could about Alaska and what they would have to do to build up their farms and to make crops and what sort of farming would work. But I suppose one thing that really saved the colony was the fact that the war came on and food was so important in Alaska that they all had to pitch in and work and make their farms as productive as they could and maybe take some job on the side, you see. So I think the biggest mistake was that they had their farms were too small. The 80 acres
wasn't
enough land.
No, I see.
I mean, so many of them did acquire larger
That's
farms.
That's what I was going to say. All the ones that I know that I've living in the area, they always had 300 or 400 acres.
Well, they have acquired it, you
so
see.
So that's how they...
Many of the farms were consolidated and one family moved away or so on.
Yes, I see.
And,
Well, now, when you were going there in
35.
35, that's when you went. That's, was your last year with the...
Well, I resigned early in 36.
I see. So then in 35, which was their first year up there... did you observe any shuffling of ground at that time? Were they beginning to get settled and organized at all in any sense of redistributing?
Well, some people left almost immediately.
Well,
you
they
know,
did.
They had 200, how was it, 200 families, and but they built only 176 houses because... the others went back. It wasn't what they thought it was going to be. Some group from Michigan, I think it was, who thought it was going to be a socialistic group, you know, a sort of a close-knit group that they could live as a...
Communal sense.
Yes, and it didn't turn out to be that. They were on their own, so some of them left immediately. And... And so, but 176 farms were built, and it was a very hectic time, you know.
Well, if there were 10 camps, this means that roughly there were 15 to 18 in families in each camp.
Yes. And, of course, they were a very conglomerate group. Some of them were very anxious to get any help that the Extension Service could give them in the way of seeds, what kind of crops to grow, and how to manage a farm, how to plant and take care of their crops. And some of them were experienced farmers, and they had the best chance, of course, to really succeed. There were a few very young families, and they thought they could do better some other place, so they were among the first, you know, that were dissatisfied. But the families who had children big enough to take care of themselves and go to school, they could devote more time to their farms.
And also they had the extra hands,
yes,
of the children too.
Yes, and they had the know-how, you know, they were farmers. Then there were quite a few who had never farmed who came. The plan was that they'd try to get a group that could help each other, you know, that they didn't all have to be farmers.
Men who have been in the lumbering business could go into,
yes,
the sawmill business.
Oh, I think some of them did. Uh-huh. But it was interesting. Some of the old-timers in the valley predicted all sorts of failures, you know.
And dire things.
Yes. But most of them were very good to the newcomers, and it was a great help. They could turn to some of the other farmers who had lived there for advice and help, and so many of them did stay. But then the war came on, you know, in 40, and there were good jobs, good paying jobs, and many of them did commute all the way to Anchorage for work. And I don't think I don't know, the last I heard, the 27 of the families were still living in the valley. Some of them are still living in the valley
today,
though they're not on their farms.
Yes. Well, through the years, here and there, I've met somebody that will say, oh yes, didn't you know I'm a child of one of the families that came up, or I'm one of the ones that came
yes.
up. And I've met them in various parts of Alaska as well as in the valley. And it always surprises me somehow, because when I came up in 49, I did hear that most of them had left. But then I kept meeting more and more, and I discovered that most
yes.
of them really hadn't left.
Some of them moved into Anchorage where they could get work, you know. And some of them moved to other places. Some moved down to Homer because they liked the fishing and I don't know what you'd call it, but anyway, it was some more diversified jobs down at Homer, or more real pioneering.
Well, now, did you extend extension services down to Homer?
Oh, yes. That was one of the main farming areas in Alaska.
How did you get there?
Well, usually by by boat from Anchorage, you know, to go down the inlet. I think there was a Princess Pat. They were small,
There were no roads down there at that time yet.
And we'd go by boat. My first trip down that way, I was to get off at Nanelchik, and when we got there, the tide was out, and so they got out one of the small boats, and I rode in a small boat, got out of the bigger boat into the small boat. And then the first mate carried me piggyback through the mud on the beach.
Up to Nanelchik?
Yes, up to dry land.
Did you stay over there at Nanelchik?
Yes, I stayed several days. It was when they still had fox farms in that area.
Well, I didn't know about that.
I think this was the summer of 35 that I was that I stayed quite a while at Homer. I went from Matanuska. They wanted me to come down to judge the fair at Homer, and so I went on down to Homer. When I was to leave Homer.
Now let me ask something. Is this during the summer that you were doing this?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because I was beginning to wonder how you traveled. By water in the winter.
I've never been at Homer in the winter time, mm-hmm. but only in the summertime.
So in other words, your work with the University Extension was a year-round
Yeah. Oh, yes,
work.
Yes.
And not we think of many teachers as going from fall
yes.
to spring, but not an extension.
No, the summer program, of course, gave us a chance to do more in the way of canning and gardening and things of that kind.
You don't mind if I...
No.
At Nanilchik, now you mentioned the fox farming on the Kenai Peninsula. And of course, when I came to Alaska, there were roads down there. In fact, my dad was one of the pioneer engineers in the road building of the Anchorage District. But so I know more about the roads, but I don't know about it before the time of mobility by highway. And that was a period, I understand, there was a lot of fur farming going on. The fur farms folded up somewhere over, I guess during
well,
the war.
Well, there was when I first went down there in the 30s, there was a fox farm or two at Nanilchik. There was some at Seldovia when I was there, some mink farms. And then, of course, down the southeastern Alaska, there were islands where they had fox farms and mink farms, and they did maintain a mink research station at Petersburg for a long time. I don't know whether it's still operating or not. I doubt
so.
It. But you see, styles vary so in furs. And when the war came on, I think people didn't wear so much fur. And
yes. Went out of fashion.
Yes, and it's quite expensive to
yes.
feed, to run a fox farm. You know, you have to catch fish all the time or produce other meat for them.
Of course.
And so... So it was getting to be less and less profitable, and I think the fox farm at Nanilchik lasted only a few more years after that.
What was the population in that area? Was there still a lot of Russian influence there?
Well, yes. I think if the churches are any indication, it's been one area where the Russian Orthodox churches have persisted, you know.
Yes, I think of it with that church up on the hill there, the big onion on top of it.
And of course, Kenai and Kasilov are wonderful garden spots and fishing areas. And so there were communities in both those places. Of course, Kenai has grown way out of proportion to what anybody ever expected in those days.
Yes.
But they had, when I was there, Kasilov and Kenai and Homer had just beautiful gardens and wonderful crops of berries and things like that, you see. So there were a number of permanent families there. Some trace their origin to Russians.
And of course, they were fishing villages, too.
Yes.
They weren't doing any crabbing or shrimping at that time, I don't
know.
No, I
didn't.
It was all for salmon.
Homer, they were trying to develop farms around Homer.
Yes.
But there was quite a bit of fishing going on.
Now, how did you get from Nanilchik on down to Homer?
By boat.
You went back up to the...
I waited for the next boat to go on down to Homer.
Would that have been a mail boat, Princess?
Yes, I'm sure it was. And then, of course, they picked up farm products to take back to Anchorage. You know.
Oh, I see.
Once when I was down to Homer, the farmers had butchered quite a few cattle. And they had the meat all wrapped up, you know, and down on the beach, and were watching for the steamer to come in. It was the day the steamer was supposed to come in, a good-sized boat. And it didn't come, so we all had to go back and find a place to stay overnight, and they had to drag the meat up off the beach up. And the boat didn't come in till the next day. And here was all this meat out there, you know, no refrigeration. And I wondered what it would be like by the time they got it to Anchorage, another day to get it to Anchorage. So you see, the farmers had...
what a pity there was glacier ice across the bay.
Yes.
They could have put it down in good ice if they could have gotten to the ice.
I suppose they'd been misinformed about the boat, or
of course,
I don't know
sure,
why.
Sure, the boat was late and there they were. Did anybody ever use any of that glacier ice, do you know? Did you ever hear of it?
Not
with refrigeration today, they don't need it, but it just occurred to me that...
They maybe did use it, but I...
Of course, they had power. They had electricity and generated yes. power for ice.
Down at Juneau, I think they used,
the
Mendenhall.
Ice, yes.
But I think it's much easier to make ice than to...
Haul it in from
haul
the
it in from a...
Seems like such a wonderful natural source.
Well, I don't know how clean it is. I guess there aren't too many germs in it.
No, just a few ice worms.
Yeah.
Well, tell me now something else. The cookbooks that have been produced. Now, I'll bet you've had your finger in some of those through the years. Various communities have cookbooks, the Petersburg cookbook and Nome cookbook.
Well, there are always people writing cookbooks, you know, and but we distributed recipes through the Extension Service. And for several years, I think at least until the war, until we had agents in the other area, my only contact with many of these areas was a newsletter that went out, you know, when I could get around to write it. And we always included recipes in that. And then, of course, the early bulletins were on canning and use of berries and fish and fish products and then game, all kinds of game recipes. And these, of course, I couldn't experiment with them and develop them myself, really, although I did a lot of experimenting in my own kitchen. But all the states have good bulletins like that and would give me the recipes to put in ours.
So you didn't really have to do a lot of innovation?
No.
I see. You didn't have to work out...
Now, the experimental stations, while they were supposed to lay the groundwork, do the research for the use of the extension agents, we never could get them to do much in the way of testing foods, the food value of foods. So we had to depend on the testing that was done in the head office in Beltsville, Washington, near Washington, D.C. They had very good equipment for testing the vitamin values and the mineral values of most foods. But, of course, people always were afraid that the Alaska product wouldn't be as good as the stateside product.
Because it grew so fast.
Yes, but, as you know, vitamin C, it's very hard to preserve that because by the time if you sent a sample of food from here to Washington D.C., the vitamin C would have evaporated or whatever it does, and so they didn't depend on they didn't like to take the stateside word for it. So, but we never could get the research department to do much on along that line because it's a very expensive process, you know, to test for. The composition of food, but we did do enough, or they did do enough in Canada to prove that Alaska foods are very high in vitamin C.
Oh my goodness, yes.
And that's one of the vitamins that's very difficult to get in Alaska. Still, they found that rose hips, for instance, are much richer than oranges in vitamin C. And so we had all the...
You distributed information on...
Yes, the health department did some testing, and they had a nutrition expert in the state who did quite a bit of gathering of information on the food value of foods, Dr. Heller, Dr. Christine Heller. She helped us a lot, though she wasn't... She was connected with the Extension Service only for a brief period, but it was with the health department. And of course, the one big problem was how to adapt the nutrition work to the native people in the villages so that they would understand it. And so that was a part of the work of getting out information about foods. And one of the Eskimo women from Nome, she was here not long ago for the short course, and she said she remembered some of the demonstrations I gave in Nome way back in the early, well, I guess that was in the 40s that I got back to Nome. I did have one trip to Nome in 34 when they called all the teachers from the native villages in for a conference at Nome, and then they asked us, asked the Extension Service to give some information, you know, on foods and nutrition and so on. So that was my just about my first plane ride was when I went over there in 1934.
What did you go in?
Oh, I don't remember.
Airplane, yes. Well, I'll bet that was a thrill.
I think there were three of us going over and we filled the plane.
I see, yes, one of those. When you presented this information to the group there in Nome, that was probably the first time they had encountered some of the concepts of food, nutrients.
Well, I felt that they knew much more about their food supplies than I did. You know, but all I could do was tell them what was considered nutritious food and maybe give them some idea of preparing it in some other way than just the way they did it, and let them have tastes of things, you know, like milk, for instance. I think there's quite a taboo, or was at that time, against milk for grown-ups. Milk was strictly a child's food, you know, so... I remember the first time down at Ketchikan when we mixed up powdered milk and passed around samples of it for them to taste. They wouldn't taste it even. And I couldn't imagine, you know, why they wouldn't touch it. And the nurse there said, oh no, they have a taboo against milk. Grown-ups don't think it's poisonous to adult people. It's only for babies and little children. So you know, when you're dealing with a native group, you don't know what their taboos are. So you just I tried never to talk down to them, but explain everything as I went along.
Well, I know when I went to Nome in '53, I was surprised at. I think the Eskimo people are very innovative, and I went out picking greens, and we picked a few greens in the field, and then we went home and we chopped them up with lettuce and tomato, and then we got out the vinegar and the seal oil and made a salad dressing, and this was the salad. And I didn't eat this myself, as a matter of fact, it wasn't my dinner table, but I mean that particular combination I did. I ate lots of Eskimo food, but that particular combination I didn't. But I know it was prepared that way for the table in one household or where I was, and it tickled me. This combination, absolutely nonchalant. You make a Western style salad,
yes,
but with the local ingredients.
Yes,
and I was delighted by this.
And they liked it too, I think.
Yes, oh yes, yes.
Yes, well.
Well, of course, they traditionally dipped greens in oil.
Yes,
and I think then they acquired the salad dressing as we use it. This was a new addition, the concept of the vinegar part. But I don't know offhand of any foods, Eskimo foods, that have a particularly a vinegary sour flavor, except that.
Well, they eat the wild rhubarb. You
yes.
know, that's kind of sour.
Yes.
And some of the sorrels, I guess, are pretty sour if they eat them. I don't know.
I think so.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I know they make good use of the plants. Christine said they did, and so she tried always to encourage them to use what they had.
Mm-hmm. Oh, she did a wonderful work.
Yes.
I have one of her first books that was put out by the Extension Service. I got it in about 1950, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
The big, you know, not the little flower volume, but the big one.
The edible plants.
Yes, edible, wild edible, and poisonous plants.
They introduced, not the people at Nome, but natives down the coast, gave me lots of ideas on the use of kelp, you know, and seaweed, how they used it, and how they used the other foods that they
Have you collected any recipes along this line?
Oh, we put them into our bulletins, of course. Anything we could get from them, we put in. But I don't think I had too many. I did have quite a few of the natives on my mailing list, you know. Well, then, of course, with the war in 1940, I should go back to 1935 when the colonists arrived in Palmer. They decided that they wanted an extension agent stationed there. So that was when they added a local agent, an agricultural agent, and a home demonstration agent. So the first agents local agents were placed at Palmer.
And who were they?
There was Ruth DeArmond and Howard Estelle. And then they were married the next year, I think, and Ruth dropped out. Well, then they got another agent in. And then from then on, they kept adding an agent here and an agent there, till now they have agents stationed in most of those areas. And as the staff grew, then they put out their newsletters instead of coming from the head office. And
now, would these newsletters give information of how to prepare foods?
Oh yes, surely. That was the main purpose, you know. It was mainly on foods and any other hints on how to get along, or make do with what you have, and how to use what is available. It was mainly for the new settlers and anyone else. It was quite a bit on. And then, of course, as the staff grew, it was possible to present more subjects and more information to the people. And then, after the agents were placed, then it became instead of trying to meet with the clubs and things, we'd have a farm institute sort of thing, you know, and the people would get together for demonstrations and lectures. And then pretty soon now they try to meet with interest groups, that is, the groups that are interested in some particular subject, like this log building with logs subject that they announced. I don't know whether you read of it or not. At the university, they offered a course of, I don't know how many lessons, but they expected about 30 people, and they got 600 applications. So you see how Alaska has grown.
My goodness.
When we were giving the institutes, quite a few of the families would come, you know. And so changing times brought changing programs, too.
Yeah. Well, it's been a fascinating period, I'm sure, to watch it change and grow. And, of course, with some of the growth is regrettable, because there is a joy in the smallness of a community.
People who've lived here all their lives, they sort of hate to see the old town disappearing, you know, and all. But
yes.
but you can't stop it.
No. Well, what was on campus there? I think I've got enough tape to talk about the campus itself. Now, when you went up there, you and your girlfriend, the first year.
Yes.
Where did you live?
Well, I always lived in town.
You stayed in town?
Yes, and I lived at the hotel, at the Nordale Hotel.
Oh, you did.
They had special rates for teachers, you know. Many of the teachers who taught in town, as well as some of the teachers who taught at the university, stayed at the Nordale through the winter, and then they'd get out for the summer, you see. But my friend was the dean of women, and lived in the dormitory.
I see.
Part
well,
of the
now
town.
The young woman who came up with you from Iowa, who became your assistant.
Yes. She was the assistant, and she was the instructor, and I was the head of the department.
Yes.
I always laugh when I think of the head of the